This is a condition that every successful person needs to have in. So when we look at the life of this person, we see that he's been amazingly hardworking, not only in learning, but also in practices. By practices, I mean that in addition to studying a lot, he's been trying to be a very pious and spiritual person.
Yes.
And we believe that when a person wants to become a man of God, mm-hmm. a godly person,
yes.
a purified scholar, a spiritual person, mm-hmm. you know, being talented and being hardworking, mm-hmm. of course it is absolutely necessary, but it's not enough.
Yes.
In addition to all of those things, the person needs to have a good level of spirituality.
That's all right.
And spirituality comes from being a pious person.
That's all right.
And it's a separate topic we can talk about.
Yes.
So we can say that regarding this person, spirituality and the level of piousness that he had, or piety that he had, was very influential in all of his successes. We call it tawfiq in Islam.
That's all right. They say, because they say sometimes the ilm that you have becomes the hijab.
Yes.
Or veil on your eyes. Yeah. Not to see the reality or the truth around you. And of course, especially if you are a religious scholar, and then you are attracted to the materialistic sciences around you, that would be very much difficult for you to be spiritually grown up. But Ayatollah Hassan Hassanzadeh Amali is different for sure. And this is because of the level of the piety that
And it goes to the level that a person like Allama Tabatabai, we have talked about him before, who was his professor, and he has a statement about Allama Hassanzadeh, which is wonderful. He says, no one knows Hassanzadeh except the Imam of our time. You know, this is unique, and maybe he has not.
This
said
is
such,
documented.
Yes,
the sentence?
He says Hassanzadeh ra kasi nashnocht juz Imam Zaman in Persian.
Okay,
and this is amazing. You know, something is not from a regular person, Allama Tabatabai, who knows what he says.
Yes,
he you know, he has a book that talks about his own life and his experiences, but he starts this book by just one line of the poetry that he mentions. نشکوفه‌ای نه برگی نه ثمر نه سایه دارم همه حیرتم که دهقان به چه کار کشت. He is actually making an analogy and says, I'm like a tree that doesn't have any fruit nor leaves nor a shadow and nothing. I wonder why the farmer has planted me. You know, he starts with saying, you know, he does not consider he does not consider anything for himself or from himself.
Okay.
That's a total pure soul.
Sayyid Mohsen Nawawi. So the role of, we can say, a spiritual growth for an alim and for a scholar is very important over here. And Ayatollah Hassanzadeh Amali, I think, is a role model, must be a role model for the students, especially the new generation nowadays. Isn't it, Sayyid Mohsen?
That is true. And obviously, we always need a teacher. And especially in the field of mysticism, you cannot obviously grow unless until you have a teacher.
Yes.
So we definitely need a teacher. Mm-hmm. And the way he had his own teachers, the way he remembered his teachers, and the way he talks about his teachers obviously shows that the role of teacher was very important in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And he himself has become a teacher, obviously.
That's all right.
The books that he have, obviously, there are many books that he wrote. And in the mystical, we can say, field, the books that he has, these are very valuable books.
Mm-hmm.
The way, obviously, he teaches, he is more teaching the practical aspect of, we can say, mysticism.
Irfan.
We have teachers who emphasize on the, we can say, theoretical part, but obviously he also shares his experiences in this field.
Yes.
And I remember, like, he, in one of his speeches he had, or statements he had, that because he do not have any more classes, it's a long time, many
because
years.
Because he
that
has been ill, that's right.
He cannot teach, and he says it's because that I revealed all my experiences, or some of my experiences that I had in the field of mysticism.
Okay.
So basically, there are hijab as well. There are the veils as well, which you should not lift.
Okay.
But he has lifted so that people can feel the field of mysticism.
The fragrance of Irfan.
Right. So that it becomes tangible for them.
Okay.
That if someone like him can achieve, then other people can also.
Very good. We'll get, inshallah, field by field to the expertise of Ayatollah Hassanzadeh Amali, including the mysticism, of course, which is the rough translation for the Irfan. It is not the exact translation for Irfan. We get to these fields of study, I mean the practical and theoretical Irfan, as tackled by Ayatollah Hassan Zadam Ali. But thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Dr. Zazadeh. Very
my
kind
pleasure.
Of you, brother. It was very kind of you. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher, which was about Ayatollah Hassan Zadeh Amali. We will continue our discussion regarding his character and works in upcoming session of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Khalaf Islam Radio. Also, a YouTube channel, Khalaf Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafi. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Mm-hmm. My dear son, carefully and very carefully remember these sayings of mine. The Lord, who is the master of death, is also the master of life. The creator is the annihilator, and the one who annihilates has the power to bring everything back to existence. The one who sends calamities has also the power to protect you from them. Remember that this world is working under the laws ordained by him, and it consists of assemblage, an aggregation of actions and reactions, causes and effects, calamities and reverses, pains and pleasures, and rewards and punishments. But this is not all which the picture depicts. There are things in it which are beyond our ken, things which we do not and cannot know, and things which cannot be foreseen and foretold. For example, their rewards and punishments on the day of judgment. Under these circumstances, if you understand a thing, do not reject it. Remember that your lack of understanding is due to insufficiency of your knowledge. Remember that when you came into this world, your first appearance was that of an ignorant, uneducated, and unlearned being. Then you gradually acquired knowledge. But there were several things which were beyond your knowledge, which perplexed and surprised you, and about which you did not understand. Gradually, you acquired knowledge about some of those subjects, and in the future, your knowledge and vision may further expand.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam. One of the beautiful things which we learned from Imam Ali, alayhi salam, can be truly represented and found in one of these historical stories which we find about Imam Ali. So Thalabi further says in one of these places in the historical texts that let it be known to you that one day I performed the noon prayers with the Messenger of Allah in the mosque, in the masjid. Amid this, a needy man rose up to ask for help, but no one amongst the Muslims responded. The needy man raised his hands towards the sky, saying, O Lord, you are witnessing that I asked for help, but no one took heed of my request. And so at this time, Imam Ali, who was bowing in his prayer, pointed with the small finger of his right hand to the needy man. On his finger was a ring. So the man who was needy went towards Imam Ali, alayhi salam, and he took this ring, which was upon the blessed hands of Imam Ali. Abu Dhar then reports that the Messenger of Allah had hardly finished this, looking towards this scene, when the angel Jibra'il, Gabriel, came down saying, O Muhammad, read. The Holy Prophet said, What shall I read? And Jibra'il said, Only Allah is your wali, and his apostle, and who believe, those who keep up prayers and pay the poor rate while they bow. This can be found in the Holy Quran, chapter number 5, verse number 55. And so we learn, dear friends, that sometimes in difficult situations or in conditions which seem to not favor giving charity, still, as Muslims and the followers of true Islam, we must find ways in which we can give charity and help the needy and help the oppressed in whatever way we can. And truly, when we see that these verses in the Holy Quran are clearly referring to Imam Ali, it makes us proud, it makes us happy, and it gives us more determination to remain steadfast upon the path of Allah, the path of helping the needy, the path of helping the oppressed. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
You for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil. And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, "Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger." Protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet. For protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
And so when we talk about, this physical fitness compared to spiritual fitness, this question comes up. Who is a strong person? Who is a courageous person? The person who can physically beat others up, you know, in arena or outside arena, or the one who can carry the heaviest stone. You know, there was an interesting story in the life of the prophet that once he was passing by in an area where he saw there was, you know, people gathered in a circle, and they are looking at something. So he went close and he said, "What is going on?" They said, "Well, there is a wrestler here. He is saying that I challenge anyone who wants to come and you know, fight with me. I'm going to defeat them." And Rasulullah didn't say, "Don't do what you are doing." Rasulullah asked them another question. "Fala adullukum ala man huwa ashaddu minhu?" Should I not describe to you a person who is stronger than a wrestler? In another incident, it was that there was a competition about, you know, who can carry this heavy rock. And Rasulullah responds here, you know, by saying, "Should I tell you who is stronger?" And when they said, "Of course," this is where the Prophet says, "Rajulun kallamahu rajulun faqadha maghaybuhu faghallahu waghalaba shaytanuhu." A strong person is someone that when another person provokes him by his words, says things to provoke this fellow, still he can, you know, controls his anger, chains his anger, and basically he overcomes his inner shaitan. And this is where we, you know, we have to learn that when we talk about fasting, yes, physical fitness is a good thing, but it's more to do with the issue of controlling our emotions, our desires, and our feelings. You know, two hadiths on this theme where the Prophet says, "Ashja'u an-nas man ghalaba hawahu." The most shajir, the most courageous person is a person who can control his emotions and desires.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil fawajahum wa al'an adahum ajma'in. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. Dear brothers and sisters, we decided to talk about some aspects of dua with regard to the traditions and the verses of the Holy Quran before we move into the commentary of Kumail's application. We talked about the value of dua in our traditions and in the verses of the Holy Quran. We also mentioned the value of dua in congregation and the state of staying hopefulness and how despair is negatively affecting the supplications to be answered. Now, in short, if the supplicant wants his dua to be accepted, he should meet certain conditions which are enumerated by the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam in valid books such as Usul al-Kafi or Mahajjatul Bayda or Wasail al-Shia. Now, since we have talked about some of these conditions in the previous versions of the program, and maybe there comes a time that we will talk about all of them in details, we'll just mention a list of such conditions. Islamic purity like wudu and ablution is a must. Ritual washing or ghusl and tayammum, ablution with soil, is another condition. Fulfilling the rights of the people or haqqun nas, which must be gained before the supplication. Sincerity in dua, precise pronunciation of dua, rightfully earned income, and observing and strengthening the kinship ties or the so-called silatul rahim. Also, charity and sadaqah before dua is really helpful. Among other conditions are the obedience to the Almighty Allah, abstinence from sins, rectification of the deeds, dua at dawn, and in witr, which is the last rak'ah of Salatul Layl. At specific times, dear listeners, dua is recommended, like dua at the true dawn, and at sunrise, and between noon and evening prayer on Wednesdays, and finally, praising the Prophet ﷺ and his progeny before dua. Among these specific times, dear listeners, is the Thursday night. This night is considered among the best times for dua in the traditions of Ahlul Bayt, to the extent that it is almost equal to the Qadr night in value. The insightful and pious theologians proclaim, spend Thursday night with praying, worshipping, and invoking Allah till morning, if you can, because the compassionate sends the angels to the first heaven to increase the virtues of the believers and abolish their sins.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the beneficent, the merciful Oh Allah, bless Muhammad and his progeny Oh Allah, I beseech you by your mercy which encompasses everything and by your power by which you overcome everything and which submits to it everything and humble before it is everything and by your might by which you conquer everything and by your majesty against which nothing can stand And by your greatness which prevails over everything And by your authority which is exercised over everything And by your own self that shall endure forever after everything has vanished And by your names which manifest your power over everything And by your knowledge which pervades everything
And by the light of your face, which illuminates everything, oh, he who is light, oh, he most holy, oh, he who is light, oh, he most holy.
It is narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam in a valid tradition. إِنَّ لِلْجُمُعَةِ حَقًّا فَإِيَّاكَ أَن تُضَيِّعَ هُرْمَتَهِ. Verily, Fridays enjoy rights incumbent upon people. Therefore, be aware of violating Friday's sanctity through showing shortcoming in acts of worship, and instead seek nearness to Allah by means of righteous deeds and abandonment of all forbidden acts. Certainly, on Fridays, Almighty Allah doubles up the rewards, erases forgivingly the punishments for evil doing, and raises the ranks. We also have it in some of our traditions that when Prophet Joseph's brother asked their father, Prophet Ya'qub, to seek forgiveness for them from Allah, Ya'qub said, "I will seek forgiveness for you soon." And he delayed seeking forgiveness for them till Friday dawn so that his exigency will be answered. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has said, "Avoid committing sins on Thursday nights, since the punishment is doubled then, just as the recompense for virtues is multifold. Whoever avoids sins on Thursday night, Allah will forgive his previous sins. And whoever openly commits sins on Thursday nights, Allah will chastise him for his lifetime of sins and will multiply the punishment of his Thursday night's sins." So, dear listeners, this specific time of Thursday night is greatly seen in the vast ocean of the traditions. Many prayers and supplications have been mentioned for Thursday night, among which Dua Kumail has a special position. We will, inshallah, get into Kumail's supplication, starting up from the name Kumail, in the next program. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe,
and we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
If you look at the plans for establishing the Zionist state, it goes back before the turn of the 19th century, before we entered the 1900s. The planning goes back to that time, according to the records that are available. And I don't know if it was there before that, and whose evil mind it came to first, Theodore Herzl, an Austrian Zionist that is considered at least one of the main people behind the whole idea of Zionism and having a Zionist government that officially rules over part of the world, and then they decided for it to be. They finalized it, and it was pretty clear they're going to go for Palestine. But anyway, that planning starts before we enter the 1900s, so it's over a century ago. Okay, you see the official announcement made of what they call the establishment of the Zionist state, Israel, in before 1950. Okay. Now we are in 2021. As you can see, despite the advancements of the Muqawama and the resistance led by the government of resistance, the Islamic Republic, and all the believers who have joined the cause of resisting kufr and tughyan, rebellion against God and against people, those who've joined that cause, they are part of it in the form of organizations, armed organizations like Hezbollah, like Hamas, like Jihad al-Islami, like Ansarullah, like Hashd al-Sha'bi, like the Syrian movement, like Fatimiyun, like Zainabiyun. All of these are part of the movement of the Muqawwam, the resistance. Because of their work, obviously what they had initially planned has not taken place. The point that I'm trying to make right now, we're explaining, إِنَّهُمْ يَكِيدُونَ كَيْدًا. Their plotting is very serious. They don't give up. With the expansion of this so-called Zionist state, or what they call Israel, they haven't given up. MBS is part of the new figures that have joined and aligned themselves, fools that think that this project is going to help them. They don't realize shayateen abuse you. They don't even use you. They abuse you. Anyone, even each other. That's what the Quran tells us in Surah Al-Hashr. They abuse each other. إِنَّهُمْ يَكِيدُونَ كَيْدًا. Or regarding the revolution, their CIA agents, Mossad agents, were helping Savak before the revolution to make sure they destroy the whole religious backbone and the spine of Muslimin in general, in Iran particularly, the Hawza. They tried to do that before the revolution. And with Imam Khomeini specifically, they tried to get him out of and get him to not to continue and pursue this. They tried everything. Before the revolution, there's a lot of measures they took. When the revolution succeeded after a few months, they started plotting against it. For 42 years or so, they have been plotting and planning against the Islamic Republic. They have been defeated over and over and over and over. The thing is, has it stopped? No, that's what this word. إِنَّهُمْ يَكِيدُونَ كَيْدًا. They keep plotting. They assassinate Haj Qasim and Haj Abu Mahdi. Before that, they had assassinated others. They are the ones responsible for the assassination of Shahid Mutahari, for the assassination of Shahid Beheshti. They're all, it's all there covertly. They're the ones responsible. They've had all these assassinations. Did it succeed? No. But did they stop? إِنَّهُمْ يَكِيدُونَ كَيْدًا. Very serious in their planning and plotting. They keep going. And they don't give up. They keep going. That's what we see, right, with regards to the Palestinians. When we're discussing what the believers and the Muqawama is doing, it's important to see their work and how they have defeated Right now, we're focusing on the Zionists themselves. إِنَّهُمْ يَكِيدُونَ كَيْدًا. They keep plotting. God knows how many plots have been there. In what ways, who's been involved. They've gotten entire organizations that were armed against the Zionists to mellow down and to go to Oslo and to make an agreement with the Zionist state after all the shuhada that gave their lives to protect Palestine. Some of those leaders over time, they lost their stamina and the whole organization gave in to accepting Israel as a state, which doesn't really exist. That's just a title given. And they've continued with Hamas. Do you think for Ismail Haniyeh and the other believers there to be steadfast on this path, do you think it's not a jihad? Do you think only the missiles being launched are the believers on the front lines that are launching those missiles and getting killed there are the only ones that are doing jihad, and the politicians of Hamas, the political figures like Ismail Haniyeh, who was probably once upon a time in the battlefield himself, but the likes of him, do you think it's not a jihad? Do you know how much pressure there's on them to agree to accept Israel as a state? How much pressure when something like this arises, how much pressure there is, and they use MBS, they use Saudi, they use Egypt, they use every possible means you could think of and things that we can't think of to pressure the political figures to agree to something for them to stop the mujahideen on the front lines. There's a line Imam Khomeini has in one of the, I heard this from some of the believers who were, it's recorded, it's online, you can find it. Some of those who were fighting in the war against Saddam, when Saddam was unleashed against the Islamic Republic. In one of those operations that they had, it became very difficult. There was contact between Imam Khomeini and the commanders in the war front, people who were commanding the believers. And the line that they were explaining how difficult it was and so on, Imam Khomeini told them to tell the believers that we are standing, you stand as well. Those believers are there, there's bullets coming their way. Imam Khomeini says, we're standing, you stand as well. He doesn't say, you guys stand, like he's relaxed back there. It looks like he's not in the battlefield, they are, but that's not the case. The battle he's dealing with is more, if the politicians give in, those believers on the front line can't do anything. They can't do anything. They would have to withdraw. They need the politicians to fight. If the politicians fight, if the leadership fights, if the leadership doesn't give in to the pressures, which are more difficult than bullets to take, the plots of the Zionists are very, they've been very strong, pressed very hard, so many different ways that we don't even know half of them. At the deception, إِنَّهُمْ يَكِيدُونَ كَيْدًا. Now, this is explaining that part of the verse. We see it. We said it doesn't need too much explanation, but I guess we did because the comparison is important. إِنَّهُمْ يَكِيدُونَ كَيْدًا. God says, yes, إِنَّهُمْ يَكِيدُونَ كَيْدًا. But he follows up, وَأَكِيدُ كَيْدًا.
No mother, no father to wipe away my tears. That's why I will cry. I feel scared. But I won't show my fears. I keep my head high, deep in my heart. I never have any doubt the battle is thine. Tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free.
And inside Israel.
While economic and health experts in Israel weigh in daily on how to save the Israelis medically and financially, there is little talk regarding a consequence of the virus that could cause the most damage: mental health. Over 1.2 million Israeli adults reported deterioration in mental and emotional state, but that figure was for the first lockdown. Now, researchers report a 40% increase in that number for a total of 1,680,000.
The first is social distancing and the quarantine. Many people are alone now, and alone for long periods of time and isolated. Depression and anxiety, we've been seeing a lot of these people getting worse, and also people without pre-existing issues. It's just a problem.
The issue of mental disorders in Israel is not new. Unfortunately, it was never properly addressed by authorities, as no funds were allocated to it. And now, with the current political chaos and budget deadlock, it seems highly unlikely that the regime would pay attention to this problem.
People are out of jobs, people don't have enough money.
Even in the military, Israelis who are drafted there fake mental health disorders just to go AWOL from the military. We are talking about one-third of the Israeli males, and 44% of females avoid being drafted into the military for mental health reasons. Mati Kaspi, one of Israel's leading musicians, posted a message on his Facebook page announcing that he and his family were leaving Israel in order to protect their mental health. He blames the Israeli regime for what he called the sad situation the regime creates for its citizens and culture. Mental health experts are warning of another epidemic in Israel. They say that the emotional and psychological impact of the coronavirus pandemic are no less severe than the havoc wreaked on Israel's health system and the economy. Psychologist Elad Mardo of Haifa University, who is behind the study, reports a 300% increase in requests for psychological treatment. The data shows that 25% of Israelis over the age of 21, that is approximately 1.2 million people, report a deterioration in their mental and emotional state after the first lockdown. This, while 26% say the emotional state of their children has taken a turn for the worse. According to the professor behind the study, these are catastrophic numbers. The issue of mental health in Israel is not new. It has always been a social issue that the regime never really found a cure for. Israelis do not seek help because there are few problems. Many people do not seek out mental health services. Mental health services cost money, and as people feel the extended economic strain, mental health support is often viewed as non-essential. About 87% of Israelis with mental health issues stated that they simply could not afford to seek help for their mental health, according to a report published by the American Psychological Association. Due to almost non-existent programs amidst the political chaos and budget deadlock, there is no support for the unemployed to relieve the most severe economic distress. Steps to address the mental health issues in Israel are not being taken so correctly. Researchers point out to the lack of educational campaigns among Israelis regarding identification of mental health problems and appropriate use of mental health services offered by the health plans. Israelis are unaware of what is available.
First of all, a lot of doctors that could provide some kind of assistance or first diagnosis, family doctors, general physicians, were not available at that time. And for a while, you couldn't reach the mental health clinics. And there was a big confusion at the beginning why you couldn't reach psychologists and mental health workers. That was one source. People were locked down at home. And that caused both social isolation and a lot of anxiety among people. People didn't know what was going on. In addition, bear in mind that people were detached from and disconnected from their communities, from their schools, from their everyday life, and all that caused a lot of stress and a lot of times depression as well. So that could explain some rise in mental health states. So at the beginning we saw the Prime Minister showing up in himself, in person, showing up in prime time and addressing the nation. But the way he addressed it, I believe, caused more panic. He wanted to make sure that people take care of themselves, maintain social distance, maintain hygiene, wear masks, although at the beginning people say it's not helpful at all, and then suddenly became helpful. As time went by, people expressed more anxiety, I believe, due to those conferences, the daily conferences. You felt that things are changing constantly, that the decision makers often are not sure about how to handle this issue. They were learning the issue themselves. And the issue of mental health was not addressed at all. It was not an issue at all. People were worried about physical health and breaking the chains of contagion. And so the issue of mental health was not addressed at all. You know, and some we had some leaders saying also, you know, that just go out and have fun, don't worry about it. This issue was not considered at all until it was a huge pressure from public services, psychological public services, that started stressing that the issue of mental health and mental wellness will be addressed as well. This issue was not handled at all.
On social media, here's what users said. Norian said, little is known about the Israeli Jews suffering in Israel under their right-wing regime, children being taken from parents. An estimated 200 fathers a year have killed themselves. I heard this in a podcast from an Israeli activist. There is much poverty. All people deserve humanity. Yossi Bernstein says, she bets more women will suffer from domestic violence than the virus. Priya says, world's first psychiatric corona ward has opened in Israel. I had predicted this would happen. Corona will eventually go away, but people need to keep their minds sane. It's a mental challenge for the world.
There is great political instability in Israel right now. And the coronavirus is being used as a political tool, for instance, to shut down demonstrations in front of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's home. The politicization of this COVID crisis is causing great anxiety among Israeli people, and Israeli people have good cause to question the actions of their government, even the legitimacy of their government.
The issue of mental disorders is prevalent in the Israeli military as well. In fact, 1/3 of the Israeli males and 44% of females avoid being drafted into the military for mental health reasons. To avoid the mandatory service, Israelis rely on a military law that allows recruits to receive an exemption on grounds of medical or health issues. According to Israeli law, any individual whose health standards is less than 21 points is exempted from the military service. Some pretend to be suffering from poor mental health or disability to score low grades, an act seen as extremely dangerous by Israeli authorities. The mental health crisis in Israel is impacting all sectors and parts
parts of Israeli society. An Israeli crisis hotline says it is receiving an unprecedented level of suicidal calls, and many of them are from people who did not have any previous diagnosed mental health issues before the pandemic started. According to the nonprofit organization that is supported by the health ministry, Iran, since the onset of the coronavirus crisis, some 5,500 Israelis who are considering ending their lives have made contact. According to Iran, it took 240,000 emergency calls since the pandemic started. About 60% of these calls are about dealing with daily challenges, financial and employment problems, mental health, and identity crises. The organization stated that 86% of inquiries come from people in crisis, or what it called emotional overload. So far, according to the organization, there is no end to these numbers in sight.
Well, in recent years, we've seen reports that there is an increase in Israeli youngsters trying to avoid drafting by reporting all kinds of mental health and other issues. About half of them, about 44% of them, were ultra-Orthodox, what we call Haredim, pretty much the same number, about 46%, were secular. In some groups in Israeli society, it became unfashionable to go to the military. I don't think it's necessarily a result of mental health problems among young people, partly, which I'll discuss in a minute, but also that it became not such a problem, not such a stigma in Israel, not serving in the army, because it just doesn't fit me anymore, and I'm not too crazy about military service, and it'll take 2 or 3 years of my life. I believe that having policies that change constantly, that are clearly affected by political issues, and decisions are not based on professional expert opinions, are very difficult to digest and to be accepted. When you see that the entire country is in lockdown, while actually only certain cities are red cities, because of a high percentage of sick people, but the entire country goes into lockdown because certain groups oppose closing down just those cities, you understand that there's little professional advice involved in this issue. And therefore, the trust in one's government, in policymakers, in decision makers, in high-ranking officials, has deteriorated dramatically. And therefore, you don't know whom to believe. When different ministries are fighting with each other, Ministry of Health, Ministry of Education, Ministry of Treasure.
On social media, here's what users said. Medusa is done, says she's sick of war and the endless glorification of war and military violence. In Israel, so many kids are gung-ho about going into combat units and end up with PTSD and massive mental health issues for the rest of their lives. But no one talks about that. Marwa says, how about Israel pays reparations for the mental health of Lebanese who endured its terrorism and still do down south? Jonathan says, if Israel cared about the mental health of its soldiers, it would stop making them be an occupying force that denies the humanity of other people.
Some people don't agree with the service in the army, but it's a tiny, tiny minority. There is a minority of people who do not want to serve in the army for religious reasons. But there is a small, tiny minority of people who feel that they cannot serve in the Israeli army for various reasons. some of them might be political, but it's a tiny minority. You have to understand that the people usually serve in the Israeli army willingly and not so much under duress. However, there is a small minority, a very small number, less than 1% or even less than that, who might opt for